Welcome back to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnall-Reed, my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer, and our guest this week, Richard Pope. Richard, Shadows Gathering has a rich cast of characters from many different backgrounds. Surprisingly wide differences, actually. There are Poles, Germans, Blacks, Irish Catholics, and English Protestants involved in the story. How did you recreate language and dialect suitable for these characters?
Well, from study of the speech of the people in rural Ontario, much of the interesting language in the book has its origins in the border counties in the English north, extreme south of Scotland, and often the people came here from those areas via Northern Ireland. And I studied and collected words and expressions in Halibut. For my first book, Me and Len, I ended up having to do a glossary of all the interesting words at the back. And Len himself, who was an old trapper and extremely lucid with a perfect memory, I learned his way of speech. And after I had worked extensively with Len, I then collected an oral history archive of the old-timers in the 70s and 80s who were over 80 or 85 in the greater area of Halliburton. And so I was sort of listening to them and learning their way of speech and learning to speak it, because I can speak with them and not stand out. And I can recreate it, fortunately, in writing. And as for knowing how the Slavs speak, the Kashubians, well, I was a professor of Russian languages and literatures, and I know how Slavs speak without articles, and I can sort of imitate their way of speech. So I had a great deal of fun trying to go for authentic language and dialect.
What about the Black family? Did you give them a very separate voice?
Not too separate a voice, because the Blacks, of course, being English speakers and having lived in Ontario for a while, they came up on the Underground Railroad through Lucan and the settlements down near London, and then eventually were moved, a group of them went to the Oro settlement just east and north of Lake Simcoe and Barrie, and that was the end of the Monk Road, which went right through up towards Pembroke, and many of them migrated along, working in the lumber camps and then staying in the community. So they pretty much spoke the same way as their white cohorts.
Right.
And a few interesting expressions, but basically they'd been here longer and were native speakers of English to begin with.
So tell us a little bit more about the Kashubian community. The character Stanny and his family are Kashubian, are they not?
They are, and the Kashubis were a small West Slavic group that lived in the extreme west of Poland, or just east, I guess, of Prussia. And in 1858, a large contingent of them, almost some 2,000 Kashubs, came to Ontario and ended up going north of Ottawa, up the Ottawa River, up to the Barry's Bay area, and then down through Pembroke and Barry's Bay, and down through Wilno and Spill, almost down to the area that my book takes place in. And of course, when they all came at the same time, they brought their customs and ways over with them, all their wedding rituals and funeral laments and dances. And among the things these people brought over with them was a great deal of folklore. The medieval Slavs in general had a very rich folklore, which, unlike Western Europe, survived right up into the 20th century. And when my friend Jan Perkovsky, ethnographer and Slavist from Texas and Virginia, came and studied the Kashubes and produced a book called Vampires, Dwarves, and Witches Among the Ontario Kashubes, I, of course, read that, but I'd been fortunate in being a colleague, and he told me all about it, and he did 2 years of field work with these people. I got a lot of my background from him.
It's always better to have it straight from somebody's mouth.
Straight from the horse's mouth.
Yes.
Yeah.
So why did you decide to self-publish your new book, Richard? Many people would be delighted to have you have your publishing history. You published with established publishers for several books before. So what do you see as the advantages of self-publishing?
Well, first of all, I should tell you that I had an agent who absolutely loved the book but got absolutely nowhere trying to place it. And then I tried and had the same luck. I couldn't find a publisher who was willing to let me publish the book as I wanted it, and when I wanted it. I wanted it out for August 2014, the 100th anniversary. And I wanted the illustrations, and I wanted the newspaper materials. And it was almost impossible to find anybody who would countenance all that. Plus the fact you don't make any real money when you publish with an established publisher unless you're really successful. So when you publish it yourself, you have the advantage. You can have the book exactly as you wish it. You can have the last word on everything, even the design, the cover. You can opt to have an editor, which I did, and they had a marvelous editor. I could have the illustrations that I wanted, just as fiction was always illustrated of old. And I wanted illustrations, and I could have all that. The downside of self-publishing is you have to market yourself. I mean, my book's on Amazon and Kindle and that, but I don't have a website, I don't Twitter, I don't do Facebook, I'm not on LinkedIn, and the chances of going viral without all that are zero, and I'm not even capable, it turns out, sadly, to self-promote. I can't even sell my book to my friends, I give it to them, and you know, I had thought I was going to be much better at all this side, I'm not, so.
Oh dear. Well, how about reading for our listeners a bit more of your book, and perhaps some of them will go out and buy it?
I hope so. The second reading I'm going to do features the send-off of the boys. At 10 o'clock Thursday morning, as they're being drawn up into marching formation on the square at the corner of High and Maple, Billy is as excited as he's ever been before in his life. He's seen parades on July the 12th and other big holidays, but he's never before actually been in one, and it's thrilling to be right in the center of things. The tension in the air is palpable. The whole town is abuzz. Looking down High Street towards the station, Billy can see people two or three rows deep, lining the street the whole way. And there's scarcely a tree that doesn't have at least one little boy in it playing hooky on this festive day. On the square, officers are fussing over their uniforms, men are checking each other over, adjusting shoulder straps to their kit bags so they'll stay smartly in place during the march. The various bands are tuning up and warming up the brass instruments. People are busily trying to fasten flags to the automobiles, wagons, and Democrats that are to be in the parade. Billy's never seen so many automobiles. There must be five or six of them, he figures. The mayor is rushing around giving last-minute instructions to anyone who will listen, which does not include the frantic bandmasters or the fire chief, who are busily trying to tie down an enormous Union Jack that covers the whole fire engine. The only one who seems to be keeping his head is Colonel Strudwick himself, who stands calmly and confidently at the head of the contingent in his scarlet tunic, blue trousers, and white helmet. All the ladies think he is simply stunning. At 10:05, the procession's ready to drive. Drivers crank all the motor vehicles to life. Colonel Strudwick draws his sword and barks in a stentorian voice, "Company, forward, march!" The regimental band crashes into a truly inspiring march at top volume, and the whole square leaps to life. Leap is an accurate description. Whether it's the rifle-like backfiring of Dr. Harding's Model T or the loud crashing of the regimental cymbals is hard to say. But something certainly spooks the fire wagon horses, because all four begin to leap and rear up in their traces, neighing madly, some pulling left, some right, but none pulling ahead. They have a good deal of trouble calming the frightened steeds down, and the fire chief swears vilely and foully before things are brought under control. Rather than hold up the procession another moment, the chief is obliged to mount one of the two lead horses and remain there throughout the parade, grinning sheepishly and waving back at the delighted crowd. If one looks down High Street ahead of the procession between the lines of spectators, one can see a seething turmoil of little boys and dogs all tearing along at breakneck speed. The little boys breathlessly screaming, "They're coming! They're coming!" as if people couldn't see perfectly well for themselves. The dogs race about in near hysteria, occasionally colliding with little boys and biting the legs of acerbic oldsters who lash out at them in fury with their canes. The weather is glorious, the cheering deafening, and at least one of the three bands is playing every step of the way. The only miscue occurs when the citizens' band up front strikes up Rule Britannia just as the regimental band farther back breaks into the British Grenadiers. As neither can hear the other, both persevere right to the end, but in spite of the cacophony, nobody notices anything is amiss. When the procession passes by the public school, all windows are wide open and every child in the school is hanging out waving a little flag and screaming yay and hooray. One overzealous little boy, carried completely away by his cheering, actually falls right out the window, fortunately landing on a trim cedar hedge some 8 feet below. Though shaken up, he's unhurt. In fact, before anybody can get to him, his arm has already reappeared out of the greenery, waving a torn flag, and shouts of hurrah can be heard from deep within the hedge. As the procession advances, the crowds lining High Street close in behind the boys to follow them to the station. People swarm over the automobiles, climbing onto running boards and roofs, and the wagons and Democrats groan with the weight of flag-waving citizens. It's an enormous crowd of people that arrives at the station to join the already considerable throng of families and relatives who've gathered there to see their young men off. Only by the most strenuous efforts is Mayor Brundage finally able to quiet, if not silence, the humming crowd. At the end of a long and rather maudlin speech in which the words stirring, splendid, noble, patriotic, and gallant appear with due frequency, and during which mothers constantly disappear down side alleys with small children, the mayor, on behalf of the council and all the citizens of Waterford, gives every recruit in turn $20, and then astounds the crowd by announcing that the Women's Institute has donated $110 to the contingent. There is wild cheering, followed by optimistic speeches by various Leicester dignitaries, who then proceed up and down the lines of the men, shaking their hands and adding various small comforts to their kits. The only sour note is struck by the aged officer chosen to deliver the farewell for the regiment, who counsels the lad to shoot to kill and to be quick with the bayonet, because if they don't, they won't be coming home at all. Most consider this morbid talk about killing and death quite out of place at such a glorious send-off, and the citizens' bandmaster has the good sense to re-establish the uplifting tone of the gathering by striking up a stirring rendition of Land of Hope and Glory practically before the old officer has finished. It is a day of constant ovations and cheering. Never have people cheered so lustily. Never have recruits been given a more rousing send-off. Never has any town been so thrilled with its soldier boys.
Thank you, Richard. That was great. Now, tell us where people can buy your book.
Well, it's available at Amazon.ca and Amazon.com, and it's available as an e-book on Kindle. Here in Coburg, it's available at Meet at 66 King East and the Sifton Cook Heritage Center, David Sundry's at 32 King Street, where you buy your lottery tickets and coffee and meet Jim the dog. This is one of Jim's picks. It's available in Grafton at Penumbra, at Brighton at Lighthouse Books. If I ever get down to Picton, Books and Company has offered to take the book. It's available in Peterborough at the Canadian Canoe Museum, and of course all over Haliburton and Bancroft and Wilberforce and places in the north.
Great. Well, I hope that distribution will pay off. I'm sure that there are people out there who will find the book fascinating. If any of our listeners would like to connect with us, please send comments, queries, or suggestions for whom we might interview in future programs to wordonthehills@gmail.com. Thanks for tuning in. We hope you'll join us for another program next week.